So good evening. I am quite obviously not the Reverend Domio Burke. She is away tonight. And apparently I was the only one crazy enough to actually volunteer to fill in for her. So here I am. For those of you who are used to seeing me in the dirt zone, this is kind of strange for me. I am in the cloud tonight due to family obligations. So we'll hope that I don't see a small blonde blue-eyed human walk in the room at some point. It's possible though, so I'm sure nobody will be opposed to seeing her instead of me, so including me. So that all said, we are continuing our study tonight of James Ishmael Ford's Intimate Way of Zen book. We are still investigating the third ox herding picture, and now we've moved on to chapter 10 in that book called The Masks of God. So just to recap where we're at, I'm sure everybody's familiar with this. I haven't been able to go back and see what some of the early discussions entailed, but the first picture in the set of 10 ox herding pictures, the first picture is the boy setting out on the path, believing that there's got to be an ox out there somewhere, having faith in its existence, but not yet fully convinced, just as we have raised an intention to follow the Buddha way, even though we haven't maybe, or when we first started practicing, maybe didn't think it could manifest in our own lives. And then in the second picture, the boy spots the hoof prints of the ox in the mud, starting to glimpse evidence that, okay, the ox is there. There is an ox out there. Just as we start to see that trace evidence that the practice works, and that we start to maybe consider the fact that our own Buddha nature is not just an abstract concept. And then in the third ox herding picture, as we discussed last week, the boy finally catches that quick glimpse of the entire bull. And Domio was talking last week about how that equates to that very kind of Zen experience. The label of it, at least, which is unique to Zen, is that experience of Kensho, or some brief, maybe a somewhat of a small enlightenment experience. Finally catching a glimpse into the reality of all things. I've studied the ox herding pictures from time to time in my practice over the years, but when Domio and I talked about this opportunity to speak to you tonight, I thought, I want to go back to the origin story and get a little more information about the origins of the ox herding pictures. And I actually found a little background story I wasn't aware of before this. A couple days ago when I started preparing for this discussion. So I thought you might be interested in this as well. The Chan Buddhist monk, artist, and poet Hakuan Xian expanded on an old Taoist story that used an ox and herding as symbols for the spiritual path. He added two new pictures to the original eight and published his new verses and pictures in the 12th century around 1178. These new additions to the ox herding pictures emphasized returning to the world and linking closely realization with everyday life. Dramatically symbolizing the path to enlightenment, his rendition became the most popular and continues to hold the position today in spite of many newer attempts to revise them. Exemplifying the close connection between Taoism and Zen, his 10 bulls became closely identified with Zen in general, as well as being a continual source of inspiration for students. So, to clarify, the original Taoist model only had eight pictures, and so it would have stopped at the picture of complete emptiness, the Enso with nothing in it. That realization of all things as they are, the boy, the bull, the jungle, the whip, the hoof prints, everything, all of it completely transcendent. But Kakuan added two more pictures to emphasize that you can't just stay in that enlightened state. You have to come back to the real world. And to use the titles that you see in some of the versions, the ninth picture is returning to the source. So from that state of enlightenment, coming back to where you are, coming back to this body and this place and this time. And then the 10th picture, and the version of the title I really like is entering the city with bliss bestowing hands. Like that imagery of coming back to the city and having bliss coming out of your hands, apparently. I don't know. But coming back to the real world and engaging all of your karma, all of your habit energies, engaging with the world of people and bills and traffic and likes and dislikes and all of that. But now bringing to that this new perspective, bringing this new perspective to those interactions. This particular point of view then is where the original Taoist model really becomes Zen, with that particular Mahayana emphasis on the Bodhisattva vow, remaining in the world and helping to save all sentient beings. So I thought maybe that little backstory might be interesting to the rest of you. It definitely was to me. So coming back to the third picture, where the boy spots the bull, has this brief glimpse of the ox. DT Suzuki, who we know was famously one of the first Japanese Zen teachers to come to the West in the 20th century and bring Zen to an American audience, if you will. He actually translated Kakuan Xian's original text explaining the ox herding pictures. And so here was what Kakuan had to say about the third picture, this translation by DT Suzuki. Quote, "Seeing the ox, the boy finds the way by the sound he hears. He sees thereby into the origin of all things, and all his senses are in harmonious order. In all his activities, it is manifestly present. It is like the salt in the water or the glue in the color." And so meaning it's there, it's present, but it's not seen as something separate, right? So when you go to the ocean, the water is salty, but you don't separate salt from water, right? They're one and the same, interlinked. So that's what that, sorry, give context to that. "When the eye is properly directed, he will find that it is no other than himself." And then a verse. "On a yonder branch perches a nightingale, cheerfully singing. The sun is warm, and a soothing breeze blows. On the bank, the willows are green. The ox is there, all by himself. Nowhere is he to hide himself. The splendid head decorated with stately horns. What painter can reproduce him?" Thought that was a quite charming verse there. So getting to the text itself. So on page, was it 84, I think. I have the wrong glasses on for this. Right at the beginning of the chapter, James Ishmael Ford puts in a little opening verse. "Children of the way don't know truth. They know the shape of their hearts up to now, the source of endless births and deaths. The fool calls itself, or the fool calls it the original self." Sorry. So that little snippet is actually from, and it says so there in the text, from the koan collection, The Gateless Gate, or the Mumonkan. It's actually case 12 in the Mumonkan, and I'd like to read a little bit of that case to you because I thought this was rather interesting. This is the case. Zwigon calls himself master. The case. "Every day, Master Zwigon used to call to himself, 'Master,' and would answer, 'Yes.' Again, he would call, 'Thoroughly awake, thoroughly awake.' And he would answer, 'Yes, yes.' 'Don't be deceived by others any day or any time.' 'No, no.'" Mumon's commentary. "Old Zwigon himself buys and sells. He has many puppet gods and devils with which he plays. But why? Look. One is calling. One is answering. One keeps awake. One is not deceived by others. But if you get stuck there, that's not it. If you were to imitate Zwigon, it would be the understanding of a fox." And then the verse is the same as the verse that we just read at the beginning of the chapter. So obviously, Mumon's commentary there, the verse that he puts in at the end of the case that the title to the chapter itself comes from. So he refers to puppet gods in the koan, and James Ishmael Ford has translated that into being masks of God. And we are kind of our own minor gods at times, aren't we? I mean, we're prone to judgment and rage. We seek vindication, and we believe the universe revolves around us and around our wants and needs. And we believe that the universe should always act exactly the way that we want it to. But our gods aren't singular. We have a collection of puppets, just like Mumon says Zwigon has. Or we have a collection of masks, as Ford suggests. Each puppet, each mask, a different face of the god that we turn into at any given moment. subconsciously choosing a puppet or a mask to play the role that we think we need to play in that moment. Moomin says of the puppets, one puppet is calling and the other is answered. I have puppets, you have puppets, right? Or we have masks, right? Calling and answering. I have a mask that calls and answers to my wife or my kids or my boss or this sangha even. But who is the true puppet master pulling the strings? Or who is the true actor hiding behind the mask? The excerpt from the koan leads us off here in this chapter because it hints at what is yet to come. This recognition of oneself not as a singular entity, but as a bundle of habit energies and karmic impulses, good and bad, that itself is part of and inseparable from our inherent Buddha nature. It leads us to investigate how we really need to first recognize this bundle of karma before we can work with the bundle of karma, trying to loosen it up. And working with our karma then in relation to the precepts and looking very deeply in our zazen can help us to cultivate that samadhi power that enables us to see the truth of all things. Zwigon called to himself because he saw himself. He saw his own conditioning. He saw his own tendencies and habits that even after years of practice, even after all of the effort he expended to become what we would call a Zen master, those things were still there. He had done an immense amount of karma work to see through his own karmic conditioning and tendencies, to recognize where he got hung up, to acknowledge the habit energies that, they would never fully go away no matter how much he practiced. And so he called to himself daily to remind himself that his conditioning was always there, ready to pop up at a moment's notice, and that he needs to constantly stay diligent, needs to constantly stay on guard, stay awake. Do not let yourself be deceived by your own karmic impulses. Ford mentions this as well in the text on page 86, the second full section there. What is the nature of personalities? They're changing or not changing when it comes to the intimate way. We have personality traits and they don't go away. Like I said, I still have a critical mind. But as the Zen teacher Mary Gates says about such traits and our practices, quote, in seeing them over and over, something shifts without our really doing anything other than the seeing, end quote. That doesn't mean there is no action. Doors open. And when they do, we are wise to walk through them. So Zwigon in the koan and Ford in his telling, take nothing for granted, not even their own enlightenment experiences, not even the depth and breadth of their training. Through their karma work, they recognize the need to always keep looking with fresh eyes, objective eyes, constantly taking that backward step, turning the light around to illuminate the self. They knew that at any moment, some other aspect of the executive eye and its various committee members and whatnot could pop up. And he would then be acting or speaking or thinking without intention, falling back on that karmic habit energy. But Zwigon also had developed very strong samadhi power, the ability to see the non-duality of all things, as the other side of that coin from that committee of personality traits and karmic conditioning. This idea of samadhi power is also evident in Kakuan's description of the third ox herding picture, where he says, quote, the boy finds the way by the sound he hears. He sees thereby into the origin of all things, and all his senses are in harmonious order. In all his activities, it is manifestly present. When the eye is properly directed, he will find that it is no other than himself. Domyo discusses this idea of samadhi power in her Zen Studies podcast, episode 38, The Two Sides of Practice, Samadhi Power and Karma Relationship. Quote, samadhi is an ancient Sanskrit word, and according to a concise dictionary of Buddhism and Zen, it literally means establish or make firm. The concise dictionary then goes on to define the term as a non-dualistic state of consciousness in which the consciousness of the experiencing subject becomes one with the experienced object and therefore is only experiential content. So this seeing into our Buddha nature helps us turn around and realize all the things that are getting in the way, all of our harmful karma ever committed by us since of old on account of our beginningless greed, anger, and ignorance, born of our body, mouth, and thought. And seeing it is really that first step, right? And you think about it, it's the third Oxherding picture, and it seems like such a huge deal, right? It's this huge first step, and we're only on the third one. It's like, good Lord, how much more? I got seven more to go. Wow. Okay, let's do this. In that first picture, we really have to raise bodhicitta and set, then resolve to set out on the path. And then the second, we start to see those little trace elements, little evidence that our Buddha nature exists. And now, with the third Oxherding picture, we finally get a glimpse of it. We have that kensho, and we know without a doubt that it's there. Great. But now what? But as we see, as we move into the fourth Oxherding picture, which will maybe not next week or maybe the week out. I'm not sure when she's planning to talk about it. When we move on to the fourth ox herding picture where the boy is wrestling with and trying to tame the ox, work has only just begun. But in the seeing of our Buddha nature, in this cultivation of samadhi power, we also must recognize all of the obstacles that get in the way of our seeing. And this requires the other side of the samadhi power coin, which is recognizing and working with our karmic habitual conditioning. So Ford alludes to this to an example in his own life when he was a surly bookstore worker who had nothing nice to say to anyone. This is on page 85, the third full paragraph. So he's talking about working at a bookstore. There was an older woman who worked the floor at Holmes Book Company in Oakland as a sales clerk. Informally, she was the senior of the crew. One day, she took me aside and said if I continued being so negative, she would have to report me to the owner. I was angry and embarrassed, and I was blessed with being in a moment when I could hear her. The next day, when I found myself saying something negative, I stopped myself. When something happened and I began to tell myself a negative story, I stopped myself. As anyone who knows me will testify, my critical nature remained, but it ceased being so poisonous. It felt like a complete turning. No doubt my memory has polished this turning a bit, but it was quick. Adjusting one's attitude may not make a person rich. It will not cure cancer. However, it can open doors. So in this example, James Ishmael Ford was fortunate to have someone trigger his recognition for him, to trigger that recognition of his own habit energy. But it can be a lot harder than that, right? We don't all always have a sort of guardian angel who can help us wake up to our own habitual negative karma. And this is why many of us have just decide once we've really committed to the practice, hey, maybe we're going to take on a teacher officially. So I can have someone sitting across from me that can help me polish that, that precious mirror, right? And wipe it free from dust so that I can see through to my own true nature. I know I've had many, many moments where I was operating on pure karmic energy, causing pain and suffering, and almost always without really intending to do so because I was falling back on habit energy, right? And so I wasn't really able to see the root causes of the suffering that I was causing myself and others. And of course, if you don't truly recognize the root cause of your own karmic habit energy, it will repeat and repeat and repeat in an endless cycle of birth and death, even if that birth and death is happening on a moment-by-moment basis, hour-by-hour, day-by-day, whatever. It's an endless cycle. And so that glimpse of the ox might end up being just a singular event that comes and goes and fades from memory, unless we continue to strive to see it. We need to not rest on our laurels. We need not get lazy in our practice. We need to keep looking deeply, keep calling to ourselves the way that Suigon did, to make sure we are awake, awake, not being deceived by others. I like to think of this as maybe getting a diagnosis of some treatable form of cancer or something, but then refusing to get treated. Right? You might go forward thinking everything's going to be fine, and that's just ignoring it and falling back on habit energy. But before you know it, that cancer is going to spread and start to cause problems. Really, truly uprooting the fetters, which is a term you hear a lot in the early Buddhist traditions, but really truly uprooting the fetters really involves being willing to be completely honest with ourselves, really seeing into the root causes for our own behaviors, really seeing those karmic roots so that we can work to really get as much of those cancerous cells out of there as we possibly can. By resolving to work with our karmic roots, we can stop living by karma alone and try to start living by intention. So Domio has this to say in her podcast episode 102, The Nine Fields of Practice, Part Three, Nyoho, Karma Work, and Bodhisattva Activity. Quote, according to the Buddhist view, even if you're suffering from the effects of causes beyond your control, societal or genetic causes, for example, or the actions of other individuals, you still have a lot to say in how your experience is right now and from here on out. You can choose to act in ways that generate positive karma, positive results, or that lead to spiritual liberation. The good results are probably not going to be easily or quickly achieved, but no matter how hopeless a situation appears, the law of karma says that you can make a difference because everything you do has a consequence, however small. There are two common delusions that arise in Buddhist practitioners regarding karma work. The first delusion is that because the self, as we usually conceive of it, is an illusion, the tendencies, habits, conditioning, and concerns associated with the self are also illusions. As is the negative karma, it generates through ignorant or selfish actions. In other words, if we just concentrate on the practice of anatta or not self, or on realizing the emptiness of self, we'll be able to just bypass the messiness of our karma somehow. But to deny the reality of karma, of cause and effect in the real, tangible world, is a dangerous delusion. The second common delusion we tend to have about karma work is that if we achieve some measure of Buddhist awakening or realization, or whatever you want to call it, we will magically transform into a saint. We'll no longer be bothered by worldly things or be motivated by selfish concerns. Through awakening, we will have simply bypassed the need for karma work. And who wouldn't rather meditate than struggle to break mundane negative habits like gossiping, wallowing in self-hatred, or seeking relief through an addiction? Who wouldn't rather study a Dharma text or listen to a podcast than contemplate why our intimate relationship is fraught with tension or the root causes of our anxiety or depression? Unfortunately, insight into anatta or emptiness or Buddha nature or any lofty truth elucidated by Buddhism doesn't magically transform the way we act. Maybe for a little bit, but our insight is just one input into our karmic situation. We have bodies and minds formed by natural selection, genetics, culture, past experiences, conditioning, as well as decades worth of our own past willful actions. It takes time and effort to integrate our insights and learn to act in accord with them. From the beginning to the end of practice, then, we make every effort we can to be good people, to minimize the harm we cause self and other, to keep the precepts and be generous, humble, and kind. We try to be good partners, parents, friends, coworkers, employees, and citizens. Through mindfulness, precept work, self-reflection, and interactions with Sangha, we get more and more familiar with our own particular negative tendencies, habits, and delusions. We learn to gently hold an aspiration to liberate ourselves from them and yet refrain from beating ourselves up or striving after unattainable ideals. End quote. Wow. So, this karma work, this facing of and recognizing our karmic tendencies helps. How can that help us see through the detritus and cultivate our samadhi power? Unfortunately, Domio goes on or goes back. Anyway, this is episode 38 from episode 38, The Two Sides of Practice, Samadhi Power and Karma Relationship. Quote, the terms samadhi power and karma relationship are ways Roshi Jiyu-Kennett described two sides of Buddhist practice. When we manage, even for a moment, to drop the conceptual filter we usually hold over our experience of life, we wake up to the absolute aspect of reality. This isn't a far-out transcendent event we force, hoping, we force to happen by working ourselves into a rarefied spiritual state. Rather, It's waking up to a truth that's always there, but we can't usually see it because we're so busy thinking and looking out for ourselves. Our impression of absolute truth when we experience it isn't always the same, but it can usually be described by words like infinite, boundless, luminous, precious, complete, full, or unconditional. Learning to perceive the absolute aspect of things and strengthening our ability to perceive it at will give us great solace and strength. The power in Roshi Kenneth's Samadhi Power doesn't refer to power in the sense of control or dominance or to supernatural abilities you could use to impress people. Instead, power refers to the ability to drop your dualistic thinking, to allow subject and object to fall away and experience the absolute aspect of reality. The term power also points to the energy, strength, and effort required to cultivate samadhi, which is ironic because samadhi is more about not doing than doing. It actually takes great effort to allow ourselves to settle into a non-dualistic state of consciousness because our habits of clinging to discriminative thought and pushing for self-centered agendas are very strong. End quote. I don't know about you, but that last statement really is very encouraging to me in my zazen. Some of you may recall I gave a talk back in August during the Sangha Voices series about Shikantaza, and I used the metaphor of a radio tower opening to all frequencies on all channels, just letting all of those frequencies in and not trying to home in on one of them, dial in just one frequency, a frequency of pleasure or a frequency of distraction or a frequency of even sadness or anger or something that's bothering me in some way I was wronged. But just letting it all arise and pass away, just letting it all pass through. It's that effort to avoid dialing in a frequency that I think Domyo is referring to here, the tendency of our habit energy to cling to discriminative thought. As she says, pushing for a self-centered agenda. I find that dropping off, not getting caught up in thinking mind, and also not getting caught up in the trying not to get caught up in thinking mind is very, very difficult. I'm sure probably we all can empathize with this. I think this is why we often have a tendency maybe to go that the opposite direction from Shikantaza and try to shut out all that thinking and stimuli by using directed effort. Practice to zero in on a mantra or an image or a sound or some concept as a way to concentrate the mind on anything other than the multitude of signals that keep demanding our attention. And I'm sure all of us have experienced this. Every time we sit, we find ourselves ruminating about the election or how we're going to solve this problem at work, or we're daydreaming about vacation, or we're thinking about what to make for dinner. All of that is that thinking mind arising. And that's actually karma manifesting in that moment. Everything that's ever happened to us in our entire existence and even before it is actually coming to bear on the fact that we're sitting there and our mind is doing this, right? And this is exactly where we face both sides of the coin. Our habitual karmic energy arises, but only by working with it skillfully can we flip that coin and use our samadhi power to see the non-duality of all things. And it really, really, as Domyo alludes to, we probably all know, it requires a lot of effort to accomplish both, to be able to balance that recognition of our karmic tendencies, of habit energies, and try to pop through, use that samadhi power to pop through. You can't have one without the other, as the old song says. Right? Domyo speaks about this in episode 72, Taking Care of Our Lives More. About the karma relationship side of practice. It's such a big topic, she had to have multiple episodes on this one thing. She says, quote, "If we neglect taking care of our everyday lives and changing our behavior for the better, karma relationship, either samadhi power will elude us because our life's such a mess, or any experience we end up having of the non-dual aspect of reality will remain shallow and disconnected from our embodied existence. On the other hand, if we neglect cultivating a deeper sense of and an intimacy with the absolute nature of reality, samadhi power, our work to become better people can get bogged down or discouraging because, frankly, it never ends. Samadhi reminds us of the sense in which our lives are already complete and precious just as they are. End quote. In the book You Are Still Here, which features edited talks given by Domyo's Dharma father, Kyogen Carlson, there's an entire chapter devoted to this topic, simply called Samadhi Power and Karma Relationship. Important. And there's a little fun little excerpt here that I thought was pretty cool. Kyogen says, Samadhi power comes from the time spent in deep zazen, just committing time to it and really doing it over an extended period of time. Through time spent in zazen, our perspective shifts from the phenomena that moves through body and mind to the space it moves through. As we shift our perspective to the space itself, a profound change begins to happen in us. I really love that idea that samadhi power relies on shifting our focus from all these things, all this phenomena that's moving through body and mind, which matches up with our karmic conditioning, of course, to the space in which it's moving through, the space it's moving through. Sorry. That the non-dual nature of just things as it is, right? Something we can only glimpse, really glimpse, in that state of samadhi. We can intellectually say, oh yes, I know the non-dual nature of all things, oh yeah, blah blah blah, but to really really see it, to really feel it, requires that samadhi power. He goes on later in that same talk to talk about the actual embodiment of this idea. Where does it start here? The enlightened view that someone may have in a moment of insight is really nice, but Zen is really not about that. Zen is about prajna, wisdom action. Prajna has a particular meaning in the Zen tradition. This kind of wisdom is not knowledge or a perspective or a point of view, but rather a way of being. This way of being means complete letting go, moment by moment, to be actualized in the present moment. Prajna arises as a response. It is action in the face of circumstance based on that universal view, action from the condition of no self. This is what Dogen calls being actualized by each mo or being actualized each moment by the myriad things. I like to imagine how that might manifest in an actual moment of real life, right? To be sure, we probably all had some moments that felt like this, right? The moments where we're facing a situation that's unfolding, right? Right here in our body and mind, with no discrimination, we're facing it with no discrimination. We've got no agenda. We've got no judgment. We're just being open to and aware of all things just as they are. Maybe it happens at a grocery store, maybe sitting in traffic. Maybe we're comforting somebody that's in anguish. Maybe we're sitting at the bedside of somebody who's on death's door. How could we cultivate that so much that it becomes our default? Could we cultivate that so much that it can become our default? I don't know. Maybe we can't. Even Zwigon, after decades of practice, had to call out to himself every day and remind himself to put away his puppets and practice. Awake, awake. So if this all seems like a bit too much, it is. Our karma work and our samadhi power are not tools, right, to get us from here to there, or to discard this state and achieve that state. They are both reality with a capital R. They're both completely manifesting in each moment. With the arising of one is the arising of the other. The entirety of the universe is manifesting right here. The bull is no different from the boy seeking the bull. The snarky bookstore employee is no different from Buddha. Zwigon's many puppets are no different from the reality of all things as they are. But how can we play with our masks of God or put down our puppet gods and realize the fundamental truth of all things right here and right now? Fortunately for us, Domyo has she has a way of bringing these things back down to earth, right? All these lofty principles. In episode 102, Nine Fields of Zen Practice, number 3, Nyoho Karma Work and Bodhisattva Action, She offers these words of solace. At least I found them comforting. That made all this seem much less daunting. Quote, "The good thing is that karma work supports the rest of our practice on many different levels. So even if we don't achieve much radical change in terms of our personalities or behavior, the work we do in this field, karma work, is beneficial. To some extent, it's the thought that counts. Our desire to change is associated with humility, compassion, and generosity. Facing, understanding, and working to resolve our karmic obstacles and issues can deepen our zazen and pave the way for insight. It's the thought that counts. Just keep moving forward, facing each new moment with fresh eyes. Awake, awake." I find that very helpful. Ford also offers his own bit of solace towards the end of the chapter. Let's see, it's page 89. Yeah. I believe this is the last full paragraph. "The big thing to recall here is that as we look at these feelings arise, several things can happen. To start, there's the bare noticing, then probably some emotional content. Perhaps this is followed by an effort to amend one's ways, if not at first, at some point. And then, the moment we think we've conquered them, we fall into a well. It turns out there are a lot of wells to fall into." Hear, hear. Thank you. That's all I've got. So, move my Zoom window back down here. Open it up for any questions, discussions. I did have a, well, I'm just going to open it up. I had a couple discussion questions, but interested to hear what people just want to riff on. Andy Takers. I see Jinryu. Hi, Jinryu.
Thank you for this really wonderful talk. And I am so grateful that you responded to Domio the way you did, because, for everybody, she sends those out to a lot of people. Can somebody talk on Tuesday night? I was just waiting, I was just going to let somebody else. And thank
people, because I never get those asks. You
will.
Here comes James.
So thank you for that. It was excellent. I have a quick question. I don't want to dwell on it because it's not entirely related to your topic, but it is something that you started with. When you were talking to Domio about Kensho, did she in fact use the term small?
No, and I did not speak to her about that.
Oh.
I listened to the last Tuesday night and I heard her use the term. And that's just a way that I've heard it described. I think the way that I've heard it described is that it could be anything from, just kind of a little aha pop through, but it probably feels bigger than that in the moment. I
Yes.
think, yeah, I think I've heard the term used fairly cautiously to avoid being like, you are now completely enlightened.
Well, maybe they are, is my point. I know of others who think, oh, well, that's just Kensho. Well, it's enlightenment. I understand, as you pointed out, that it happens like that. But as someone who has not reached enlightenment, I mean, how do I know that enlightenment isn't going to be exactly like that? And so I do push back and on anyone who calls it, oh, well, she just had Kensho, because I do know of someone who does that. And I just think it's unfair. It's enlightenment, period. Maybe a different kind, but it is. That's all.
Yeah, it's weird, and I know she's talked a little bit about Satori as well, which I'm like, what does it even mean? And I think maybe my understanding of Kensho is that it's, I don't want to say small or minor, but maybe more just like a flash in the pan as opposed to maybe a longer extended. I mean, obviously, I don't know either. That's my perspective, but
I mean, to your point of longer extended, how do we know that? I mean, Jack Kornfield has a book, First Ecstasy, Then Do the Laundry. I mean,
It's a good
you know,
one. Yeah.
so that's my point. But thank you. It was a
Yeah.
great talk.
Yeah, very good.
Yeah. I think my perspective on that, just to maybe address your question a little more concisely, I think my particular view of Kensho or any kind of enlightenment experience is very, very heavily tainted by my past in the Theravadan tradition, where it's like it's all or nothing, and once you got it, you got it, and you never lose it, and you're like you achieve nibbana, as they call it, like you fully enlightened, like completely, you're an arhat, the whole thing. Like even if you're a lay person, you would like immediately sell your house and give away your possessions and ordain like instantly. You know, it's like it was that understanding of it kind of that's part of the reason why I kind of went So I probably have a slightly jaded view of that. And that's why I wanted to maybe Kensho was just like, oh, it's a little pot too. It feels good. You know? But I don't know. You're right. We don't know. So, but thank you. Leah.
Sorry, okay, I'm gonna lower my hand, gonna unmute myself. Okay. So first of all, about Kensho and Satori, I always thought, and I'm just saying this because I'm not sure if it's accurate or not, traditionally accurate, but I always thought Kensho was, like you said, a little flash, and Satori had a little bit longer staying power. That's kind of what I thought. And then Kensho had a very always has like a kind of positive spin. Whereas Satori is more like a, doesn't have to be necessarily a happy or joyful glimpse. It's more like a, doesn't, I won't say sad, but it's just like not necessarily happy. But anyway, that's from my, that's kind of what I've heard. But the other thing too is I like going back to what you said about the ox herding pictures. The ninth and tenth ox herding picture. I think those pictures are so important because, and thank you for bringing it out because I'm going to go back and study that more now. Because it does bring you back to your karma work and your life. And like you said, the Theravadan tradition. You sell your house and go away and ordain and everything. It's like, yeah, but it is that necessary or right? Or like, does that help anything or do anything? I don't know. I just really, I really like those last two ox herding pictures, and I'm glad you mentioned it, and especially the Taoist version versus the Zen Buddhist version, having that coming back to the world. And being in the world with your, and I think it doesn't have to be like this, referring to a long arc of time either. It could be like short. It can be like I went through the Oxford pictures. I had a little Kensho, and then I went back and had breakfast. You know what I'm saying? Like time doesn't necessarily work in Zen the same way. It could be like this little thing, or it could be a really, really long thing, and it doesn't really matter how many kalpas, right? Anyway.
Thank you. Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up about the importance of those pictures, the last two pictures, and the importance of the Mahayana ideal of staying in the world, coming back to the world. My Buddhist practice started off, I spent a lot of time around monks who had just abandoned everything, and they were living in hermitages way off in the forest, and they had no money and they couldn't cook their own food, and and I began to realize over time that every time they would give a talk and they would try to relate real life experience to some Buddhist teaching, I'm like, they were going back 25 years in their own life because they ordained when they were in their early 20s and now they were, 50 or whatever. And I was like, I was hearing the same stories over and over again. And I started to realize, like, I want something new. I want some more relevant, and okay, you've got stories from so and so pissed you off because they didn't make the rice the correct way at the monastery. Okay. I mean, I can relate to that to a degree, but so I really started to miss that Like, no, like, what about if you're stuck in traffic and you're rushing to get to work and you're going to get fired? You know, like, I want stories that can help me with that. And I wasn't connecting the dots in that tradition. So not to badmouth it. Obviously, it's got its benefits, but for me, it wasn't jiving because I just couldn't relate to that lifestyle, you know? So I appreciate you saying that because, yeah, that's one of the things I love about Zen and the Mahayana tradition in particular is like, what's that got to do with this, you know? So I appreciate that. Thank you. We got 9 minutes. We just sit around and stare at each other. My son was joking with me about it. He said, "Dad, you really have a love for pregnant pauses or awkward pauses, don't you?" It's like they're not awkward for me, man. I could sit here and stare at you for full 15 minutes and not feel like, okay, somebody say something. One benefit of my training, yes, knocked one thing out.
Pauses are good. That's the sign of a good teacher, that you're comfortable.
Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Thanks for the energy. I didn't realize just listening tonight that I needed a lift about, oh, too bad I didn't start doing this 30 years ago. And I thought, well, that's a dead end thought about anything. But yeah, your whole delivery was uplifting. Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth Ann. Much appreciated. I bow to you.
You promised us your daughter. You promised us Anjali.
I know, I did. She,
Now I'm like waiting to see her. Hi.
don't know, that she may not come in. I've got a special sign that I put on my door when I'm in here doing Zazen or Zen stuff. It's got this lovely picture of a monk, you know, he's got his back to you, he's got his robes and his bald head and everything. Like, I wish I looked that good. I don't look that good right now. Well, we can knock off a couple minutes earlier if nobody has any other thoughts. Okay. Well, I sincerely appreciate everyone's attention tonight and participation. It's been great. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thanks, James.
Translation, body supplements my house.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God.